Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Well, it's a summer edition of Nostalgia Digest magazine, which is out now. Steve Darnall is the editor and publisher of the magazine, which is celebrating its 50th anniversary. And Steve, I think you're celebrating your 20th at the helm of it all.
I just began my 20th year at the helm with this new summer issue, David. Absolutely.
As Chuck Shaden turns 90.
Yes, I don't know where that time went.
I know. The summer edition has a fashionable Lucille Ball on the cover. It also includes articles about the lives of Lassie, the 90th anniversary of the Lux Radio Theater, The Man of a Thousand Faces, actor Lon Chaney, the groundbreaking Calling All Cars, radio's first true crime series, and memories from the Digest from founder and Radio Hall of Famer Chuck Shaden, as well as some memorable moments from the publication's first five decades. Happy summer, Steve. How are you?
Lovely, David. Thank you so much for inviting me back.
Absolutely. 50th anniversary of this magazine that I love. I think I might have some original issues from the early 70s where Chuck just typed them out on his typewriter on some 8.5 by 11s back then. But I love this magazine because, you know what? No politics, no news of the day, and it's a great escape, isn't it?
Well, you know, I think as Paul McCartney said, you know, it's okay sometimes to be somebody's aspirin.
Yeah.
You know, I'm very pleased that we've made it to the 50-year mark, and I'm very pleased to have been a part of that. But, yeah, I think one of the things that's really nice about Nostalgia Digest to me is that, yeah, it allows you to, you know, take a moment, look back at the past, hopefully find something for which you can be nostalgic and you know, something that's worth maybe preserving and bringing into the present. You know, I don't think anybody wants to look at the present and say, oh, forget all of this. We've made no progress at all, because clearly we have. But you hopefully find something in here that reminds you, okay, we can be nicer. We can be more courteous. We can do something that maybe resonated then that resonates now.
I agree. Yeah. I agree with you. NostalgiaDigest.com is where you can find more info and subscribe, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. But let's talk a little bit about the history of the magazine, and for folks mm-hmm. that haven't seen it, what it's all about.
Sure. Well, Nostalgia Digest is currently a quarterly publication that is dedicated to what we call life during the golden age of entertainment. And for those who never, you know, that's one of those amorphous terms. For mm-hmm. our yeah. benefit, it's more or less the first 60 years of the 20th century, you know, give or take
that's
a few
fair.
On either side. So mm-hmm. Most of it's a lot of it's dedicated to movies, to radio, sometimes to early television, sometimes to popular music. And as you point out, we've always tried in every issue to have some personal recollections of the era, just because, I mean, I love getting to publish articles about Lucille Ball and Lassie and whatnot, but it's also nice to hear from somebody who was there and get some context from this time, you know, just to remind us that if some things seem unduly simple back then, it's because in a lot of respects it was a simpler time. It was a pre-internet era. It was a time before we knew everything that was going on the other side of the world, you know.
Well, the other thing, too, is I think that there's a lot of actors of the day, movies of the day, especially, you know, some radio shows, obviously, of the day that are not very visible to a younger generation. And I think what this magazine does, what your Those Were the Days program does, is takes people back to that time and it educates you a little bit on the history of, as you said, the golden age of entertainment in the early parts of the 20th century.
Well, and that's something we've always appreciated getting to do. I mean, you mentioned the Calling All Cars radio show, and there was an article about that in the Digest. You know, you're right in that that's not a show that people automatically remember 90 years later.
Right.
But without it, you know, we wouldn't have had America's Most Wanted for two decades, or probably for that matter, we wouldn't have Cops, although that's a very different show. But we wouldn't have necessarily even had Dragnet, you know,
and right.
The fact is, all those shows owe a debt to this show that maybe people don't know about, but those names in and of themselves are a compelling reason why people should know about it. And you're right, that's what we get to do at Nostalgia Digest, is remind people all the things you love about the present, a lot of that started in the past.
That's very true. That's very true. And I was going to say, too, like, you know, you talk about true crime. True crime has never been more popular, especially in the podcast world. And I think that's why people need to rediscover some of these shows, because this Calling All Cars, just to give a little perspective on this, 1933 to 39, and they were dramatized cases that have been handled by the Los Angeles Police Department. So these are real stories. These aren't, you know, pretty much written just for radio or for broadcasting in any form, but this was, you know, an actual true crime series, which is really interesting to listen to 90 years later.
Absolutely. And one of the things that is especially fascinating about it to me is that, of course, in those days, David, radio was live. And so that meant the dramatic shows were going out on the air. And William Robeson, who was the director of Calling All Cars, actually had an instance where they called him and said, you know, there's been a break at San Quentin Prison. Can you do something about it? And
wow.
And literally he's typing up a script as bulletins are coming into the studio, and, you know, then goes on the air with the story about how, you know, the men broke free and how they'd been tracked down by police and were brought back in, and went off the air. And literally as he comes out of the studio, he hears that the newspaper extra editions have just come out. So he actually, you know, this is a radio show that actually wow. scooped
yes.
the community.
Yeah.
But you're right. I mean, my gosh, you think of all the podcasts, think of all the documentaries on all the streaming platforms
yeah.
about true crime. And you're right. People have always been fascinated by it, but Calling All Cars was the first radio show that really brought it into people's homes.
And there was a publication that had a circulation of about 500,000 that went along with this program. And I'm just saying, like, I didn't, you know, I find myself to be an old-time radio buff. I had no idea of the show. And this is what I'm talking about with Nostalgia Digest. You learn something and introduce yourself to something that you haven't heard or seen before. Lucille Ball is on the cover. But in yes. this issue, it's more about Lucy as a fashion icon back in the day.
Yes, I mean, we adore Lucille Ball, as everyone does, and we had this lovely, wonderful writer, Annette Bojanek, who had submitted this article to us, and we thought it was great because, obviously, it's always great to recount the career of an iconic figure like Lucille Ball, and we've certainly done that within our pages in the past, but it's equally wonderful if you can take somebody that the world sort of feels they know and learn something new about them.
Yeah.
In this case, yes, that Lucille Ball actually started her career as a model, and that she watched actresses come into the designer's office, you know, the office of the designer where she worked, and she got to learn an awful lot about the way movie stars dressed, the way they carried themselves, and that was inspirational to her. And then, yes, the fact that we think of Lucille Ball as this marvelous clown and comedienne, which she was also a bona fide movie star in the 30s and 40s who
right.
worked with Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer. And, of course, that's a studio that spared no expense when it came to, you know, dressing its talent at the absolute height of fashion. So
it is a tale of two Lucys, because, you know, most people, again, know her from her later work, and it really was her later work in the 50s through the 80s in television. But, I mean, yeah, being a movie starlet, MGM, as you mentioned, RKO Studios, you know, yeah, they kept her at the top of the fashion scene.
Absolutely. And even on I Love Lucy, you know, she didn't dress like a frump unless the occasion called for it. Like, obviously,
true.
If you're going to masquerade as a hillbilly,
right?
Yeah, but you know,
yeah,
or
right.
go stomping in a vat of grapes.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, when she, as the article points out, when she was at the Ricardo apartment, she dressed like a woman of some means whose husband had a decent job and, you know, could afford you know, she wasn't going to wear dungarees and you know, tattered and frayed anything. And, you know, that's the sort of thing you don't necessarily think about until someone reminds you of it. And of course, it was a great excuse for us to put this fantastic photo of Lucille Ball on the cover, too.
Absolutely. I was going to say, she also had addressed the part of studio president. I mean, she was the first female to hold that title in the 60s. So you talk about dressing for performances. She also had a dress behind the scenes. Off screen, Lucy kept her life private. But some years ago, I spoke to the actor that played Little Ricky, Keith Thibodeau, and he shared what it was like working with Lucy.
Lucy and Desi were like my family. I mean, they were my Hollywood family, and I really had sort of a split life. I had a life in the Valley, San Fernando Valley, there in California, and then I had a life in Beverly Hills, you know, with Young Nurses, and I was best friends with her children, and I was one of the trusted people that Lucy would have over for playtime with her kids, and we'd watch movies and go bowling and go to the ocean and ride horses and go to Rams football games and Dodger baseball games. And so, yeah.
And Lucy kind of treated you, you know, and I've read this in your book that you did some years ago, that, you know, she treated you like one of the family. What do you remember her best on the set? I mean, was she, you know, Desi was kind of the unsung hero of really the production of the show. Was Lucy, did you get a sense that Lucy was really in charge of what was going on the set?
Oh, well, she definitely was the diva of the set, and she called a lot of shots. But Desi was he was sort of the brains behind the whole thing. Lucy was more of the star. In fact, she was the star, no doubt about that. And she operated in a way that was very protective toward me, because I was the, you know, a little child.
You're the kid. So, yeah.
Yeah. So she did her role in that manner, and was very protective of me and made sure that none of the, you know, the technicians would cuss, you know, or whatever, you know, around a little kid.
Sure. Sure. How about working with, Vivian Vance and William Frawley?
Well, they were great. I mean, it was definitely a professional set. Lucy expected everyone to be professional. Desi was a little bit more easygoing and more creative in that sense, but Lucy pretty much ran a tight ship, and you know, you were expected to know your lines and present them in the right manner. And Fred and Ethel, or I should say Viv and William Frawley, were great people. I mean, they were professional. They did their job. And like anybody else on the set, and that's what we were in that sort of camaraderie. And even as a kid, Lucy, I remember when I was on the set, Lucy said, don't call me Mrs. Ball, or don't call us by our last name. Everybody's by their first name here. So here I was, this 5-year-old kid calling Lucy.
Out of respect, of course, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but I mean, she didn't want me to call her last name, you know?
Yeah.
So that was interesting, you know?
It's pretty cool. Now, Bill Frawley, you know, he seems, you know, just by what we know of him, seems so gruff. Yeah, he got along with kids okay? He got along with you all right?
He did. I mean, I had no run-ins with Bill at all. I mean, he was just kind of a, you know, how's the world treating you today, Keith, you know, and that kind of guy, you know, and just meeting him, you know, and he was just an old shoe kind of a guy. And, you know, there was a little bit of tension between he and Viv, you know, you could tell that at certain times, but none of that was really exposed in a great way before me.
Yeah. What do you remember about being on the set at the time? You know, obviously, you know, this was at a time where television production was just developing. You know, what was the earliest recollections you have of being there? I mean, you were a little kid when you started. Do you remember being and seeing that live audience for the first time? I mean, what are some of the highlights for you?
Yeah, I mean, it was shot in front of a live audience, so there was a definite energy in the air, and even through our rehearsals and dress rehearsals, there was just energy around the whole production that just catapulted everybody and empowered everybody in a way that was very unique. And you know, I look at it like this. You know, it took everybody to make that show. It took the writers, the directors, the cameraman, the makeup people, the stars, of course, to make the Isle of Lucy show what it was. And Isle of Lucy, of course, wouldn't have been anything without Lucy.
And that was Keith Thibodeau, Little Ricky from I Love Lucy. We are talking to Steve Darnall of Nostalgia Digest magazine. The summer edition is out. NostalgiaDigest.com is the website. There's more with him next on 720 WGN. All right, let's talk a little bit about subscribing to the magazine. What do you got to do? How much it is? All that good stuff, Steve.
Yes, subscribing is delightfully easy, David. It's one year is four issues, 64 pages each for $19. 2 years is eight issues for $34. You also get the digital version of the digest along with the print version. So in case you're traveling and don't want to carry a magazine with you, it's there on your tablet. Anyway, the most direct way to subscribe is probably through our website at nostalgiadigest.com. You can also send us a check or a money order to Nostalgia Digest, Box 180078, Chicago, Illinois, 60618.
Very cool. And when this magazine started 50 years ago, Chuck Shaden was at the helm of it. He's got an article in here about just growing up in Chicago.
Yeah, we found this piece in a recently released book and asked about getting permission to include it. And yeah, Chuck, of course, one of the things that was great about Chuck Shaden as the host of Those Were the Days and the publisher of Nostalgia Digest when he was in charge was that he was very free with his memories and very encouraging about other people sharing them. And, you know, it's great to see his recollections of the Chicago that he knew as a child. And I don't want to say how many years ago this was, but he'll say it in the magazine. Don't worry. But, you know, to remember the days of being in Norridge and taking the streetcar into Chicago and going to Riverview Amusement Park or to downtown or to Wrigley Field or wherever the case may be. And then in turn, you know, reminiscing about the school dances at the high school and how those were set up all those years ago. You know, like I say, it's always a pleasure to get to share memories of that time, because if you're lucky, you get someone like Chuck who can make it clear in his words how it's different from the present. That's really what you're at, because a lot of us can say, oh, I remember when we did this and we did this, and when you're describing it, it may not be readily apparent that this was 20 years ago or 40 years ago or whatever the case may be. But when you can say, oh, we had to take the streetcar, and yes, this is when Chicago had streetcars.
Yeah,
that makes a world of difference in terms of setting the scene, and
very
that's
true.
I think one of the things that makes these articles in the Digest so special.
Absolutely, you've got The Lives of Lassie, which I love because you know this was this was kind of a short story in the 1800s, and then in the 1930s a story, then a movie, and then various iterations of radio and TV programs. I mean, talk about a long-lasting character, right?
Yes, I mean, Lassie's one of those animals that, you know, one didn't necessarily think was going to become iconic, but again, in the golden age of Hollywood, it was entirely plausible that a dog could become a movie star, you know? Mm-hmm. And of course, it was Louis B. Mayer, who ran Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, was a very sentimental person from all reports, so when he got the chance to tell a sentimental story like Lassie Come Home, you know, he leapt at it. And you're right. Then credit goes to the trainer who taught Lassie how to do all these things, and, of course, to all the actors who made it really seem like the dog was the hero of each story. And you're right. The fact that Lassie went on to a lengthy career in television and even appeared on radio as herself,
yeah,
so to speak.
Yeah. There's also an article on Lon Chaney and the 90th anniversary of the Lux Radio Theater, which was a pretty prestigious show back then.
Yeah, Lux was really the first show to embrace the idea of the movie capital on radio. I mean, there had been shows that broadcast from the West Coast, like Hollywood Hotel, which brought big stars to the microphone. Although Luella Parsons, the hostess, was so powerful as a gossip columnist that she didn't have to pay any of them, and that didn't sit too well. Lux, on the other hand, the Lux Radio Theater was willing to spend top dollar to get top talent, and it was really the first radio show from Hollywood that embraced the spectacle of Hollywood. You know, the very first show from Hollywood had Clark Gable and Marlena Dietrich, and it's hosted by Cecil B. DeMille, and my goodness, you know, stars and spectacle don't get bigger than that. And over the years, the Lux Radio Theater not only presented, of course, loads of great and major talent, but it also was the first time that the Hollywood community could really go from the screen into people's homes. And that was immeasurably important to the studios and to the stars, who now realized, they didn't just have to be distant figures on a screen. They could be people that you purportedly got to know and like, because here they were in your living room on your radio.
Right. No question. NostalgiaDigestMagazine.com to subscribe. Very affordable. So much fun to read. I always look forward to when I get it in the mail. Congratulations on the 50th anniversary. And the big edition on the 50th anniversary is coming up this fall. And we'll talk again then.
David, that sounds great. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Steve.